08-4173, United States v. Michael King, Jr. Morning, Mr. Campbell.
Good morning. Counsel. If it pleases the Court, my name is Stanley Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Michael King. This is a case that involved the search of an automobile in which Mr. King was a passenger. The facts of it were that an officer approached the passenger side of the vehicle, opened the car door, and once he opened the car door, he saw that there was, in fact, a handgun that was there in the car near
now,
Mr. King.
Mr. Campbell, would you agree that the relevant question is whether the officer had reasonable suspicion to open
yes.
that door?
Yeah, I think that's the issue, Judge.
Okay.
And there were four factors that the court relied upon in coming to that conclusion that there was a reasonable suspicion.
You know, in Maryland versus Wilson, the Supreme Court held that police officers may order all of the occupants out of the car during a routine traffic stop with no particular suspicion of criminal activity beyond the cause of the traffic stop. And why would that not be the end of the case here? If an officer can order a passenger out, then the Supreme Court has already decided that opening the passenger door is a small, justifiable intrusion for general officer safety. And if the gun was in plain view as soon as the door was open, what is the intrusion here that you think needs to be justified?
Judge, there are two things. First of all, those weren't the facts of this case. There wasn't any testimony that either one of the officers ordered either the driver or the passenger out of the vehicle.
They ordered them to show their hands.
Pardon me?
They were ordered to show their hands.
Yes, that's correct.
Do that.
There was testimony that as Officer Hoffman, who was approaching from the driver's side of the vehicle, came up to the driver's door, he ordered some discrepancy as to whether he was ordering just the driver or both the driver and the passenger, but he did say, show me your hands or put your hands on the wheel or something
and,
like that.
And they refused to do so.
It is correct that the driver did not. The question would be whether the order was directed towards Mr. King, who was in the passenger side of the vehicle, and whether he could have even heard that command, because although the driver's side window was down, the passenger side window was up.
Could I ask you, though, are you trying to draw a distinction between the police saying, get out of the car, at which point the occupant of the car opens the door and gets out? That's case number one. And case number two, where the officer just goes up and opens the door of the car on his own? Is
yes.
that?
Yes.
That's your line between
yes.
Maryland against Wilson in this case?
Yes.
In other words, do you think it's more intrusive for the police to pull the door open than for the passenger
yeah.
to open the door when ordered out of the car?
Well, when there hasn't been an order to get out of the car, at least.
So you're relying also in part then on the ambiguity vis-a-vis Mr. King about whether he was ordered to show his hands or get
right.
out of the car.
And the other thing about it in the Maryland v. Wilson case, it seemed to be pretty clear the court was limiting it to the specific issues before them in that particular case.
Well, they always say that in Fourth Amendment cases, right? They're very factually
yeah.
specific.
The other thing, it seems as though a search has to begin somewhere. And it begins with some physical act on the part of the police officer. And it begins when the officer either opens a briefcase, opens the door of a house, opens the door of a car, which gives him the opportunity then to look and see what he can ascertain. So
taking this one step further, though, I actually have an officer safety concern.
Mm-hmm.
Here are these two officers. And if they were actually to wait for Mr. King to open the door of the car, he's got this gun in his lap, they could wind up looking down the barrel of the gun, whereas simply by opening the door, they spot it right away, they're able to take protective measures.
if you look backwards from the fact that Mr. King did, in fact, have a gun, then you could say that.
But I'm also trying to look forward to the next stop and the next stop and the next stop, where if the officers have to stand around there outside of the car waiting for the occupant to arrange things to his liking, in general, this could lead to risk to police officers.
It could. But, of course, our view is that there was nothing that the officers saw that gave them any reasonable basis for believing that Mr. King was either armed or that he was dangerous.
Well, no, wait. He testified, Lixon testified that he noticed Mr. King moving his shoulders up and down, possibly placing something in between the seat and door. And both of the officers agreed that both of the occupants were gesturing and shifting a lot more than is typical in a traffic stop.
That was the testimony. The actual thing that the officer observed was a dipping of Mr. King's right shoulder. And I guess the question is whether that is suspicious enough by itself to warrant a belief that he is armed and dangerous.
The other officer saw the driver with his hand under his right leg. It's a lot of odd movements.
I would suggest that the conclusion of the officer is a self-serving conclusion. I would suggest that more times than not, when an officer makes a traffic stop, what's the first thing that a driver or an occupant is going to do? You need your registration to show to the police officer. So where is that registration? It's in your glove compartment, your counsel. So what are you likely to see if you're looking from behind? You're looking, or you're seeing people in a car looking around to see why they're being stopped. They're getting into their glove compartment, their counsel, to get their registration. Nothing suspicious about it.
But in the real world here, these police were not really interested in the traffic stop.
They were not.
I mean, they're just not interested in that. Mm-hmm. People on the street, they don't have any idea what Wren says. And
no.
If they did,
no.
They would never have a gun in
no,
a car.
Sir. No.
They stopped this car because it came from a kind of a gang area at 10:30 at night. And so they waited, and eventually everybody commits a traffic violation.
Right.
Except perhaps Judge Romer.
You're absolutely right. There's a big difference about there's a big difference about what we talk about and the reality out on the street that people live with.
So the reality on the street is
you're going to get stopped.
You're going to get stopped.
If you're in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
You'll get stopped.
Yeah.
If you're in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and you're a young Yahoo, and the police have a basis to stop you, they're going to stop you, and they're going to get you out of the car. That's the way it is. And with the house,
and they're also going to take into account the house that you started out with, and their knowledge of that house, and squirming around that makes them nervous.
The house is sort of a circular argument, because what the officers have to say is, well, this is a known gang house. How do you know it's a known gang house? Because there are known gang members that are there. How do you know there are known gang members? Because it's a known gang house.
They
said was they'd visited that house on two occasions. The one time was based upon a noise ordinance or loud noise that they heard coming from the house. The other was they were there to arrest someone, although they didn't specify what they were arresting them for. So it could have been anywhere from a traffic ticket to a murder warrant that was out. There was nothing about their visits to the house that would in any way lead to a conclusion that this was a gang house. The other thing was, when I asked the officers, well, what led you to the conclusion, they talked about the fact that the department just set eight criteria, and if you fit two of the eight criteria, you were designated as a known gang member. But when I asked them, they couldn't say what the eight criteria were, or even if they could, what the two were that Mr. King fit, and both acknowledged that they'd never seen Mr. King at that house before.
But, you know, he's a felon, and he's got a gun in the car. And he should know, or somebody should send a memo to all these people in Fort Wayne and say, don't drive a car with a gun, because you're going to get stopped eventually. And everybody's stopped. Everybody looks nervous. And
or limit the amount of crack you carry around on you so you don't hit the guideline.
Yeah, just have personal use amount of crack. Yeah, sure.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Kolar.
Good May it please the Court, Josh Kohler for Appellee United States. In this case, there were two police officers who were confronted with a very tense and very dangerous situation. The officers saw the defendant as a passenger in a car leaving a house that they knew was a gang house. The reason that they knew this was a gang house wasn't just because of some multi-factor test. It was because one officer had spoken to gang members of that house, and both officers had previously executed arrest warrants at this very house. They did follow the car.
It's quite obvious that that's what they thought.
And Your Honor, both officers at the suppression hearing essentially said as much. We were waiting for them to commit a traffic violation, and that is obviously permitted.
This was a pretty cheesy traffic violation.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, it doesn't make any difference, but they were making a turn, and while making the turn, they put the signal on. They didn't put it on early enough. Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
At a key intersection on top of that, where they really had to turn.
And the Indiana Code, Your Honor, does specify, I believe it's 200 feet ahead of the turn. And under Wren, obviously, the subjective reasonings of the officers has no bearing here. So what's important, though, is what happened after that traffic stop, because the stop really isn't contested here, nor could it be. After the officers activated their emergency lights, the car failed to immediately pull over.
Okay, I need to ask you about that. How quickly must a driver pull over in order for the delay not to give rise to reasonable suspicion? Because a half block, okay, you have to perceive that the lights and sirens are intended for you. Then you have to find a place to safely pull over without slamming on the brakes and killing everyone in the car, etc. So what's reasonable?
Your Honor, what makes this case, I wouldn't say that half a block is unreasonable. But what's important here, and what the district court judge, who saw the testimony, saw the officers, and actually questioned the officers to a certain extent, concluded is that this was part of the multi-factor test that went into the totality of the circumstances, because it slowed down. It continued driving very slowly for a period of time.
But so does anybody ask them whether there was a parking place, you know, or would have they just had to double park if they had... Stop. I mean, you're not supposed to just sort of stop dead in the middle of the street. You do have to pull over. Are those facts explored?
Your Honor, I don't believe the record explores those facts.
So for all I know, it was like downtown Chicago. Maybe Fort Wayne's not the same, but there are plenty of places I can visualize where you wouldn't have a parking place for a half a block.
Yes,
or even a driveway to pull into.
Yes, Your Honor, but there's also nothing in the record to suggest they eventually pulled into a parking space. What's significant?
It's a half block. I don't know how long the blocks are in Fort Wayne either. So.
But what is significant is they drive slowly for a period of time. Essentially, the squad car is trailing them at a very low rate of speed.
You know what's funny? If they'd been driving fast, you'd be here saying, you know, they were driving too fast.
Yes.
So you've got them coming and going.
That's why you ought to have a seminar on Wren in Fort Wayne and tell who that's. You can't drive a car without making a traffic violation. And if they're intent to stop you, they're going to do it.
And Judge Evans is going to teach it.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think it certainly shouldn't be the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Or maybe
the federal.
Why not? You'd have less people driving around with guns in their cars. If they knew how easy it was to be stopped and get the gun out and prosecute it. I think the U.S. Attorney would... Well, you have lower conviction rates, but maybe the streets would be safer in Fort Wayne.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, this was a felon in possession case. This was someone who was not allowed to carry a firearm.
Correct.
Whether he carries a firearm in a car or decides to walk home that night, the danger is created by him.
So I want to explore this idea that the police can come open anybody's car door that they want to. I mean, I do see a difference between telling somebody, get out of the car, at which point the person gets out of the car, and then just, and on the other hand, just going and pulling the door open.
Yes, Your Honor. And what happened in this case was not an officer simply walking up to a car and pulling a car open. By the time that door was opened, the officers had seen the car leave a house known to be frequented by gang members. They had pulled over the car, and they had ordered the defendant to show his hands. That was the belief of the officer who went to the door.
But I thought the record was very unclear about whether that order was directed only to the driver or whether there had been an order directed to Mr. King.
There is conflicting testimony as to what Officer Hoffman said. Officer Lichtenstein's belief was that both... And the trial court judge went into this. The belief of the officer who opened the door, which is what matters here, is that both the passenger and the driver of the car had been ordered to show their hands and failed to show their hands. So you have someone who was reaching from their waist to the door, pulling something out of their waist, putting it by the door, and now they're not showing their hands. That's when the door was opened. And respectfully, it's at this point where there is reasonable and articulable facts that warranted an officer to fear for their safety. And just as Pennsylvania versus Mims talks about the inordinate risk of any traffic stop, the inordinate risk that that poses to officers, here, when you have someone reaching from their waistband, putting something next to the door of a car, and then not showing their hands, that risk is all that much more heightened and clearly justifies the very small intrusion of opening the car door. As Judge Rovner pointed out, the officer clearly could have ordered the defendant out of the car door. And the difference between the intrusion, between ordering him out and opening the car door, is very minimal. And it's justified here by the fact that the officer shouldn't have to wait, shouldn't have to see what's going to come out of the door when he orders it open, whether it's going to be the gun first or the defendant first. Once he has those reasonable and articulable facts that justify his suspicion, he should be able to open that door and neutralize the threat to officer safety. And it's for these reasons that the government would ask that the trial court be affirmed in its ruling on the suppression hearing. The officers acted reasonably, constitutionally, and took appropriate steps to ensure officer safety. With that, the government would rest on its brief.
Okay. Mr. Campbell? Mr. Campbell, you were appointed to take this case, and you certainly served your client admirably, and you have the great thanks of the court for doing so. So thank you. And, of course, you have our thanks as well for coming here and serving your client.
Coming here from this hotbed of litigation, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Right.
We've got another Fort Wayne case coming up, the second to last case today.
Okay. 08